Okay, I'm going to today talk about magnetic dynamos and magnetic helicity transport and some astrophysical implications. There will be some topical overlap with if you were here for Axel's talk, which I wasn't actually, but a different perspective, and many of the people are different, so at the end of the day it'll be hopefully different. Okay, so to put some of this in the big picture, of course, most people work on the sun here. In general, I mean, we want to understand the origin of magnetic fields because they're observed, and because throughout many astrophysical sources, they're an intermediary between gravity and radiation. And in particular, they're often present in turbulent media. So accretion disks, sun, stars, and galaxies, they're all turbulent, they're all rotating, they all seem to have magnetic fields. One of the paradigm connections that one might make between the sun and between other turbulent systems is the presence of both open and closed field lines. We know in the sun that there are open field lines along which the solar wind flows, and there are also closed field lines from which solar flares emanate and such. This is also a paradigm which I think applies well to accretion disks. We know that accretion disks have winds, and there are MHD models which are very popular for generation of these winds, and they appeal to large-scale open field lines. We also know in accretion disks the presence of X-ray flaring from, for example, Seyfert galaxies, which are likely associated with closed field lines. So there is an analogy between turbulent magnetospheres in accretion disks and in stars just from that simple picture alone, I think, so from that big picture alone. So it's natural to expect that some of the same processes, the dynamics and such, we want to understand in a sort of general picture, general context. Clusters of galaxies, exactly, should be in that category. I totally agree. Exactly. And of course, these are all turbulent media, including clusters of galaxies. There, the turbulence is potentially driven by outflows from galactic outflows, or the motion of galaxies themselves through the cluster. Mergers, exactly. And the generation, of course, of turbulence is different in all these cases. In the sun, one has solar convection. In the galaxy, one has supernova explosion as the primary driving mechanism. In accretion disk, one perhaps has the magneto shearing instability, the Balbus-Hawley instability. Now, obviously, this problem is complicated. When you put turbulence in the origin of magnetic fields, it's complicated. So numerical simulations and analytic calculations and such play a symbiotic role. I want to just emphasize that I don't think simulations are in themselves an end-all, because even to solve fairly simple problems, one has to make approximations or restrictions in the nature of the simulations. So one has to understand the limitations, say, of the boundary condition or other approximations in these simulations when one goes to apply the results. And that will play a theme later in what I'm going to talk about. So if you keep in mind this picture of two different scales of fields in what I'm going to talk about, I like to distinguish between small-scale fields, and those I define as field ordered at or below the input scale of the turbulent forcing. And for the amplification, for the in situ amplification of such fields, I like to refer to that as the small-scale dynamo. There's also a large-scale field component which I would like to define as the field which is ordered on scales larger than that of the input turbulence. So these two scale separations, I think, distinguish two conceptually different aspects of field amplification, in situ field amplification. By the way, I should mention that the in situ amplification of field is, we know, is going on, for example, in the sun, for one simple reason, which is that the field reverses sign. If the field had been accreted from the ambient medium, the field would maintain the sign of its flux. Whereas in other systems in which people apply the in situ amplification, for example, galaxies, we don't have time to watch any field reversal. So the question of whether the field can accrete as opposed to be amplified in situ is more of an open question. Now, in the case, incidentally, of accretion disks, it can be argued, simple analytic calculations, that if you try to accrete a vertical large-scale field and your disk is thin and turbulent, the field will tend to actually diffuse outward. That remains to be actually demonstrated, and so there again, if one wants to appeal to large-scale fields, I mean, that remains to be demonstrated in simulations. Specifically, that simulation has not actually been fully done, but the analytic argument suggests that the field would diffuse. So in accretion disk, if you want to appeal to a large-scale field that produces an outflow, there, although there's no direct observational evidence for producing, for the need for such a dynamo, that's a particular motivation for doing so. Whereas the sun, we have direct, clear observation that in-situ amplification is absolutely required. So that, with that introduction, let me put this in a sort of spectral picture, and you can ignore tiny for the moment. And just again, large-scale field, here's the input scale of the turbulence, and input scale of the forcing, and large scale is scales k less than that, and small scales is k greater than that. The spectrum, so several of the questions that one is interested in answering and also matching to observations is, what is the actual spectrum of the magnetic field in these regions, and also what is the total integrated power in these regions? So the spectrum and the power are kind of two fundamental questions that one would like to understand for the basic amplification processes. So focusing now first on the small scale dynamo, field amplification on scales smaller than that of the input turbulence, the traditional results, both in simulation and in analytic calculation where possible, gives the general result that the magnetic energy grows to near equal partition with the kinetic energy. Now, I say that in an integrated sense. So that is, if you imagine now, to simplify the system, take a box, force it randomly with turbulence, and watch, and then calculate the total magnetic energy in that box. Don't put any helicity or anything in the turbulence, just stir it up randomly. You will find that magnetic energy grows to near equal partition with the kinetic energy. Now, the shape of the spectrum is another matter. In the classic picture of how this amplification grows, proceeds, the picture was as follows. You pump in kinetic energy, a turbulent Kolmogorov cascade ensues. On the small scale, the eddy turnover time is the shortest. You lock up the magnetic energy there first, and then slowly you build up to equal partition on each successively larger scale, approaching near equal partition up to approximately the input scale. So in that classic picture, you would have expected that the small scale field does something like this. That is, here's your kinetic spectrum. You pump in your turbulent kinetic energy, and the field builds up to near equal partition, nearly approaching the input scale. However, it seems that simulations do not show this effect anymore. And what they show is
cascade time scale is much shorter than the
field amplification time scale. It turns out for that argument, it doesn't matter all that much in the sense that the time scales for the magnetic cascade and the kinetic cascade, everything is cascading, are all kind of approximately equal. It's just that, the way I described the picture, right, it sort of implies that you go down from the kinetic cascade first and then amplify the field. But actually, once the thing is in its fully nonlinear regime, the time scale for the kinetic to go down is the same as for the, is for everything is, all of the exchanges on a given scale are approximately happening on the same time scale in that picture, once the thing fully sets into its saturated state. So you
never had the situation where you could get these first, your dynamo there, and then the whole thing cascades down.
So what I described was sort of the classic picture of the kinematic regime, where you start out with a weak field, turbulence amplifies, so the field is very weak. Eventually, when the amplification builds up to some certain value of the magnetic field, then the rate at which you're putting in stuff into the magnetic field is also the rate at which stuff is draining out. So in a steady state, you develop a kind of steady state spectrum of one form or another once the steady state ensues. But what the shape of that spectrum is in the steady state is has changed. The picture has changed recently in the following sense, which I'll describe. So if you don't put in magnetic helicity, what seems to happen to the spectrum, and these are simulations of Marin, Jason Marin. If you look at the curves, the bottom curves in this picture, this is a energy spectrum, and for the moment, look only at this solid line. Turbulent.
Could you mention what kind of simulation?
Okay, right, sure. This is a spectral simulation. It's a box, 64-cubed periodic box, and forced in the velocity equation with a random forcing function. Yep.
Well, periodic in two directions.
Right, that's right.
Not in three.
No, in three dimensions. There's no mean field here.
Periodic in three directions.
Fully periodic, yeah.
So you can't just define magnetic helicity like this, can you?
In this case, yes, you can. You can. You can define small scale helicity. So, in this case, if we ignore helicity, we don't have to worry about that. But if we do put in helicity, the helicity that's put in, it can still be defined.
I think this question is related to the possibility of having an imposed field. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, there's no imposed field here. Sorry.
Oh, right, I'm sorry.
No imposed field. That's absolutely true. There it gets very. Yeah, and in all the simulations which I'll discuss also, which do have a large-scale field, there I'll mean a field which is k equals 1, not k equals 0. So it would not be. The Prandtl number in this thing is 3. But actually, let me describe the effect, and then I'll make a comment about the Prandtl number. Okay, so without helicity, the bottom curve here represents the magnetic spectrum, and the forcing scale of the kinetic energy is here. So what you see basically, and this has been later now demonstrated in unpublished work for 128 cube simulations, which actually show the effect a bit better, the field is actually peaked towards the resistive scale. Even though the total energy is contained in magnetic energy density contained in here is comparable to the kinetic energy density, the peak of the spectrum is shifted towards the resistive scale. The physical interpretation for this is the following: that if you think of a power spectrum and you think of a magnetic field line which is elongated with a large kink in it, so something like a current sheet, for example, which has long direction in this long in this direction but short in the cross direction, that gives you power on the small scales. And so what's happening is that at the end of the day, the turbulent forcing seems to be giving you large folds in the field line. And it's the large scale eddies which actually give you directly small scale power. Because imagine when you make one fold like this and now you come at it with another large scale eddy, you end up getting something that looks like a structure like this.
Sorry, how did you infer that this whole structure occurred just based on this?
Oh, well, I was giving an interpretation of the spectra of peaking of magnetic energy peaking on the small scales, based on the concept of this interpretation has been discussed by Marin and colleague to some extent, and also there's a somewhat analytic calculation by Shikoh Sheehan et al. That sort of builds on this principle a little bit. So the point being that you generate large folds in the magnetic field here, and so with the large scale motions directly, you generate shear. So you imagine large scale eddies shear the field and generate small cross field directions, and that's where the power comes from on the small scale. So it's sort of an interesting conceptual difference from people who have been familiar with the intuition in this field for a long time. This is sort of a simple way of explaining why the power seems to pile up on the small scale, but a sort of simple picture which hasn't entered the intuitive thinking before very recently. So that's the key point also is that, of course, it's the large scale eddies that directly give you small scale power from this effect. This is interesting for several reasons. One is that if you look at the galaxy, a popular site for studies of turbulence, you find that the small scale field, now even the small scale field, and now I'm by small scale in this picture, it's from here over. I will talk about this regime in a moment, but from here over, if you look in the galaxy, you typically see that the small scale field is in near equal partition on the input scale of the turbulence. The galaxy, typical input scale is 100 parsecs. That's based on supernova driving. And the field there is about a microgauss, which is an approximate equal partition with the kinetic gas motions on that scale. The evidence, therefore, seems to be in the galaxy, which is a forced turbulent system in the sense of this box, is that, in fact, the field is not piling up on the resistive scale, but the field seems to be piling up on the input scale. So the observations, and also that's true in clusters to some extent, I think also there does seem to be the fact that the field is piling up on the input scale. So one wonders, I mean, even though one takes these, you know, you have a periodic box, you do the simulation, you can understand physically what's happening in the simulation, why does it not agree with observations? The answer to that is a little bit odd. It's maybe not entirely clear at the moment, but one possibility is to look at the role of inputting kinetic helicity into the spectrum. And we know, as I will talk about in a moment, the role of inputting kinetic helicity on the traditional large-scale magnetic field, on the classic mean field dynamo. But it is also of interest to study what the influence of putting kinetic helicity is on the small-scale spectrum. And that's what we did in this picture. We changed the fractional kinetic helicity as defined essentially by the ratio of this quantity. This is a units of energy times the wave number at the forcing scale, and varying that quantity. And one can see, remarkably, that as one increases the kinetic helicity, the peak in the magnetic energy moves from the resistive scale up to the forcing scale, and one somehow emerges back with the classical picture of the near equal partition of the two spectra when one has maximal, when one puts in this kinetic helicity. So the interesting thing that seems to emerge out of this, and this part of the spectrum, it's not fully understood, to me yet exactly what is causing the shift of the spectral peak from small scales to the forcing scale.
In that simulation you keep pointing to there, that doesn't have any kinetic resistance to it?
Sorry, the different curves, I should have pointed out the...
Sorry,
let me back up a moment. The solid curve here is the zero fractional helicity case, and each of these represents successively more kinetic helicity. So the one that has the maximal is the dotted, this top one here. And you can see that the dot is actually kinetic, but the magnetic, the dotted and the solid here are the kinetic energy.
Is it true that the magnetic energy density at small scales is higher than the kinetic energy density at small scales?
Except at the very, very maximal one. So in the very maximal one, which corresponds to the two. It is true that they're very close. In this picture, all of them, well, that statement does apply to all of them. If you look at the parameter space more globally and even with higher resolution simulations, the kinetic energy does undershoot the magnetic energy at the smallest scales, even in the fractional helicity one case, but by a much smaller fraction than in the case when the fractional kinetic helicity is zero. So that's, so the fractional kinetic helicity zero case here goes way over the kinetic energy line here, whereas the maximal helicity case overshoots not by quite as much. So the trend is generally increase the fractional kinetic helicity the spectrum becomes more close to alphanic. Well, that's another way of saying it.
What's the magnetic helicity?
Right, now the magnetic helicity, of course, this ends up inducing a transfer of magnetic helicity. I will discuss that in a moment. This the input of helicity in this problem is kinetic, and that also that has the effect. Let me get to that point right now. Notice also that this large scale peak here, this is again the magnetic energy is this dotted line, and you can see that for the large fractional helicity cases there's also a secondary peak in the magnetic field which appears at wave numbers less than the forcing scale. So whereas in the zero helicity cases we not only get the one peak of magnetic energy towards the resistive scale, when we put in the fractional kinetic helicity, we get two peaks, one at the forcing scale, so this camel, the double-humped camel, one at the forcing scale, and one at the k equals one scale. That is now well explained, as I will do, in terms of the alpha effect, the classic alpha effect of magnetic dynamo theory, mean field dynamo theory. One can understand when you force with kinetic helicity, you have in this system what's called an alpha squared dynamo. And the generation of the large scale magnetic field here is directly associated with the generation of large scale magnetic helicity. Now, conservation of helicity will then dictate that you have to generate a small scale helicity of the opposite sign, magnetic helicity. And that theory is kind of borne out, and I will proceed to expound on that and say those things again, hopefully.
How much does that depend in your experiments on the ratio, the initial values? The initial ratio is the magnetic helicity and energy.
You start out just forcing with kinetic helicity, and what you end up is with a segregation of magnetic helicity between scales of opposite sign. And the thing that it really depends on is the fractional kinetic helicity that you input into the problem. And the reason for that has to do with the dynamo growth rate, the large-scale dynamo growth rate, depends essentially on how much kinetic helicity you put in. It's the difference between kinetic helicity term and a diffusion term. And the diffusion term, of course, is more or less fixed by the turbulence. And then by ramping up the kinetic helicity, I mean, basically the essence of the growth of the large scale field depends essentially on this quantity, where alpha is related to V dot curl of V. So if this is small, essentially the growth rate of the magnetic energy. So ultimately, at the end of the day, if you put in kinetic helicity below a certain fraction, you get decay. And if you pump in enough kinetic helicity, then this can overcome the decay, and you get growth of the large-scale field. So within the framework of the alpha squared dynamo, which I'll come back to again.
So you're not considering the regime then when you have more magnetic helicity initially than
kinetic helicity? Right, I'm not.
I'm just remembering vaguely those old simulations of Montgomery, when he found that you got different end results. You would get dynamic alignment and so on. Depending on the initial state.
Yeah.
That was freely decaying turbulence. That was not true.
Yeah.
You also did some force turbulence.
Right. I don't remember that the initial ratio to matter and moles was just in the decaying turbulence. The initial ratio was critical.
The hysteresis effects, to a large extent, right. I mean, it's the system. I mean, in these problems, the way that I'm discussing the problem, one's always starting with a weak field relative to kinetic energy, and in that regime, there's very little hysteresis actually. In fact, experiments have been done where one pumps in initially, starts with the seed fields of various spectra, and you always end up with the same at the end. I mean, weak, very weak compared to the turbulent forcing, but if you put in kind of seed fields of various spectra that are weak compared to the same turbulent forcing, the system sort of evolves to the same thing.
You've always got no main field.
In these simulations, in this discussion.
As well,
yeah. Okay. I should mention that. Right. I've collaborated with Jason Merrin. He's the actual simulator person for these particular. Now, although I should also mention that now the case with the maximum fraction of helicity, we did a sort of this study of the changing helicity. Axel has also investigated the case of maximal fractional helicity in detail, with an emphasis on looking at the growth of the large scale field here. And I'm going to migrate into the theory of explaining the large-scale field growth. So I wanted to plant in your mind the concept of the traditional mean field dynamo as an explanation for the growth of that large-scale field, and I'm going to now proceed to give a dynamical theory that is a theory which is not kinematic, but actually includes the back reaction of the growing magnetic field on the turbulent growth, which can explain the simple case of the alpha squared extremely well. But just to give some basic background, the mean field dynamo, again, magnetic field grows on scales greater than the forcing scale. Traditionally, one requires this finite alpha helicity. And in a real system, the manifestation of the alpha dynamo is often alpha omega, which involves turbulence, rotation, and a density gradient. It has been, the generation has been a controversial issue, large-scale magnetic dynamo, because the coefficients, the alpha effect, and the turbulent diffusion, which govern the evolution of the mean field, have been argued to be quenched, and the level of quenching depends on the growing magnetic field. So the textbook theory that one sees for the mean field dynamo is one in which you impose the dynamo coefficients, and then you you just assume that the growing magnetic field has no influence on these coefficients that are actually driving the growth. And so there's been a kind of long-standing issue since the 50s, actually, of trying to understand how the magnetic field does affect the growth of these. And various angles on this have been debated. There seems to be a successful one that emerges, which I'll try to describe. Let me just give a quick picture of the traditional textbook paradigm for dynamo, mean field dynamo, and I'm going to then come back and show some equations. So the traditional picture, if you imagine this is a system which is rotating, and imagine it's a disk for these purposes, suppose you have a toroidal field that's lying in the plane of the disk, and you have an eddy which rises up. The eddy, if there's a vertical density gradient, wants to twist in the opposite direction to the underlying rotation to conserve its angular momentum. And the action of that twist gives you from your toroidal field a poloidal field. Now, because the statistical sense in each hemisphere of a rotating system is to have these loops twist in the same direction, which is anticyclonic compared to the underlying rotation, the net mean result of all of these loops spread over your disk will be to produce a net loop of mean poloidal magnetic field under the action of differential rotation. This poloidal field will then get sheared back into the toroidal direction. So mathematically, physically, this is the alpha effect, is the twist. The omega effect is the shearing once you get a large-scale loop. And the turbulent diffusion is present, it is required to be present depending on what mode of amplification you want your field to be amplified in. And what I mean there is that if you imagine these two plates bounding the thickness of the disk, say the galaxy, if I want to generate a net flux out of this dynamo, I have to diffuse the top part of this loop through the boundary and the bottom part through the boundary. Otherwise, when I integrate over the surface, I get zero net flux. So the essence of the beta effect, or the turbulent diffusion, is in this particular case to generate your quadrupole mode, and this is the model of the galactic field. And it is, of course, a key important observation to assess dynamos as to whether or not there really is a net flux in the disk. The observers of the galaxy would say that there is. If one looks at the data, it's quite noisy. But if one believes that it is, that's sort of the general picture. So the full dynamo in an astrophysical system such as the galaxy requires all three, the alpha, the omega, and the beta effect. Now, the equations, the way one produces a model for this is to divide the quantities up into mean and fluctuating components. And the fluctuating, and then one ends up with a mean field induction equation of this form. Small means fluctuating, mean means mean. And so this is your mean field equation. The alpha effect enters in through this turbulent electromotive force here. Beta effect also enters here. And question is, a question is, what is the form of these particular quantities? Now, typically what one does to derive the form of the turbulent EMF is, one, you have your mean field equation, and then I go to in the textbook kinematic case, one imposes the velocity, and then one uses the evolution for the small scale magnetic field to get an equation for dB by dt. And then when you do this, you end up with your traditional v dot curl of v term in this equation. So this first term here in this equation comes from assuming that ignoring this as a dynamical variable, using the small scale evolution equation for dB by dt, this is what we get. Now this term and only this term. So this term, what is this term? Well, this term first was proposed by Piquet, Frisch, and Lira in a classic paper. They have the full spectral closure scheme for MHD turbulence, which which ultimately has a more sort of more complicated version of this equation. But ultimately, this term represents the back reaction from the velocity evolution equation onto this coefficient. So if instead of just composing v as a variable, now one writes down instead, so traditionally one would write down v dot curl of v is equal to integral of v plus some term which is small. Now, when you include the dynamical evolution of v, one has now two terms. First one, which is there, and then one has a second term, which is and so in here, now one uses the Navier-Stokes equation. And it's the use of the Navier-Stokes equation that gives you this extra term. Now there are approximations and such which go into all this into this formalism, but one can proceed with this sort of generalized form of alpha and see what the implications are. Now I call your attention to the fact that this is a current helicity, a kinetic helicity minus a current helicity. And if you have a system, take a simple system, periodic box system, the current helicity is related to the magnetic helicity. And so, let me see what this, let me try what that, so let me, I'll come back to the point. Keep in mind, current helicity is related to magnetic helicity. And if the large-scale generation of magnetic field, if large-scale, so helicity conservation is going to play a fundamental role in understanding the influence of this term in the back reaction. So let me now consider the following. Let us write down, we know that magnetic helicity is a conserved quantity, so let us write the magnetic helicity for the large scale field and for the total field. And that's what I've done here. And this, of course, in a periodic box system, this is, and I'm in this, and what follows for this part of the discussion, I'm going to assume that the large-scale field is force-free. This turns out, as Axel has shown numerically, to be very much the case for a periodic box simulation of an alpha-squared dynamo. Alpha-squared dynamo now has no shear, and it just has a forced kinetic alpha effect. And that's the absolute simplest dynamo that one can study with this formalism. So what happens is instead of writing down the equation for the mean field itself, you can write down the equation for the large-scale magnetic helicity, which for this simple system is directly related to the large-scale magnetic energy. So the growth in the alpha dynamo approach, alpha square dynamo approach with the alpha and beta effects, the alpha and beta effect enters in exactly this form. So the growth of the large scale helicity is given by this E bar dot B bar term, and the alpha effect enters in exactly this way. I can write down an equation for the large scale magnetic helicity which is associated with the mean field, and I can write down one for the total, which is the sum of the large scale plus the small scale. Now, you notice that in those curves that I showed, there were two peaks in the spectral curve, there were two peaks that appeared in the magnetic spectrum when I put in sufficient kinetic helicity. And that helps to justify the next simplification in this theory, which is to make a two-scale approach. The two scales now correspond to the forcing scale and to the large scale. So I write down 1 for the large scale and 2 for the forcing scale. And I simply rewrite these equations for the large scale magnetic helicity and for the total magnetic helicity. And I can further manipulate these equations into one for the large scale magnetic helicity and one for the small scale magnetic helicity. And on the right-hand side here, where you see the alpha, I have the kinematic alpha, the V dot curve of B component, and I have the magnetic correction term, the B dot curve of B, which I have related, it's a current helicity, but I've related it to the magnetic helicity. So if you look at these, this equation and this equation, you can see something that's quite remarkable, which is that, so this is now a dynamical set of equations that says, how does this system of large scale and small scale field respond to forcing with helicity? And what you see is that, okay, supposing I have initially put this kinetic helicity in here at sufficiently large value to combat this decay, then I'll get a growth of the large-scale magnetic field. But I don't get it for free. I get it at the expense of having to grow the opposite sign of the small-scale magnetic helicity. And the small-scale magnetic helicity is actually growing of the opposite sign. So if I have a positive alpha effect, I grow a positive large-scale magnetic helicity and then a negative small-scale magnetic helicity. But the negative small-scale magnetic helicity enters into this growth coefficient in a destructive way. So as I grow the negative small-scale helicity, I deplete this overall growth term and therefore slow the rate of growth of the large-scale magnetic helicity. So this back reaction of the small-scale growth of magnetic helicity on the large-scale growth is an essential part of this ultimate saturation of the theory. And what one can do is now study this system of equations, the full time-dependent ordinary set of differential equations. One can study this and compare it to various simulations to see whether the simple analytic model fits the kind of growth of the field, growth and evolution of the magnetic field that one sees in simulations. Now, the first, and you can also notice other things too here. One is that I can consider the system in a steady state by setting the time derivative is equal to 0, and then see what the implications are for the overall alpha effect. I can, if I think of a real system, I have boundary terms which I might have to worry about. But for the moment, let's ignore the boundary terms. And let's consider first the steady state implication of these simple set of equations, this one and this one. It turns out, with a little bit of manipulation, I'm not going to we use everything on this page, but you can rewrite that set of equations, two helicity equations, in the steady state as a suppression formula for alpha. And I should mention that some of the analysis on this page is grown out of recent collaboration with Axel. This alpha in the steady state, you can write if you put everything in steady state. And if you further assume that there's no field gradients, so now instead of considering a system which is something where you're asking for a field to grow, if you just consider what the alpha effect is in the absence of field gradients, you can see that this term disappears, and what you have is a result alpha equals alpha 0 over 1 plus rm b bar squared over b equipartition squared. That form, without this term, is been one of the forms proposed for alpha suppression, and in particular Cattaneo and Hughes, 1996, did a simulation with a uniform magnetic field and measured effectively the alpha for that situation in which the field is not allowed to grow, and got this value exactly, alpha over 1 plus rm v bar squared over v equipartition squared. So one of the lessons of this study is that only emerges in the steady state. That does not emerge as a formula that's valid for all time in the evolution of these equations. It emerges only in the steady state. So one immediately can see the limitations of this formula. In fact, if you look at this formula, you would predict that the field growth, if it were true for all time, would be absolutely negligible in astrophysical systems, because for RM, for example, in the galaxy, which is 10 to the 17th, this alpha would saturate at an extremely, extremely small value of the large-scale magnetic field. So the steady-state value for alpha, which emerges, is a quenched value, but it only emerges in the steady state.
Could you have shown this without the vision of the small and large scale that's probably wrong?
In this formalism, no. In this formalism, it's a tremendous one of the cogs in the wheel is to make this two-scale approximation, and that helps tremendously. It may be possible to show without that, but at the moment, it doesn't jump out at me in this formalism. One is working with a mean field formalism, and by definition, alpha is a averaged coefficient of mean field growth. So you're sort of this comes out of a formalism which is based on mean field theory to begin with, and as long as the small scale field is dominated by some particular scale. I mean, you could have a range of scales, but you can also write all these equations in a weighted integral form, which weights over the small-scale field. And then I'm sort of making the approximation that one of those scales is sort of dominant. And then, I mean, but so the answer, I guess, is you could, but all your quantities would be now weighted integrals over a full spectrum of scales. It would mask the essence of the basic interpretation to do it that way for present purposes, but in principle it could be done. Now, let me. So the first message is that this catastrophically suppressed form of alpha only emerges as a steady state from these helicity evolution equations. But now let me jump to the dynamical case straight away. These pictures represent the full what I'm going to show now is a full solution of these equations. Full solution of these equations, and with a comparison to an empirical fit, semi-empirical fit that Axel made to a full 3D numerical simulation of exactly the same problem. That is, he simulated a 3D alpha squared dynamo in a periodic box, and then plotted the field growth as a function of time. And I'm now going to show a comparison of the results for the numerical solution of this ordinary set of differential equations, which based on helicity conservation, to the empirical fit that Axel provided for his simulations. And these results are in a paper that I written with George, but also Axel and I have been working on extending a lot of this, generalizing it, and Axel's done calculations for alpha omega dynamos as well as alpha squared dynamos. We're still trying to interpret them at the moment. But these results represent the solution of this helicity set of helicity evolution equations as compared to a full simulation. And what you see here is that I've plotted now the large-scale magnetic helicity associated with this, and the lines represent the solution of this ordinary set of differential equations, and the dots essentially represent the empirical fit to what Axel found for his simulations. So these are not exactly data points, but these points are curves which fit well the data that Axel had produced, the calculation Axel produced. And so what one sees is that, at least for late times, I'm going to emphasize what happens in the very beginning time, the large-scale field, the growth of large-scale field is well described by the growth of large-scale magnetic helicity, and the simulations and this set of simple equations match really quite well. This is for different magnetic Reynolds numbers assumed, and there are a few other choices of scale parameters. The forcing scale over the input over the large scale is 5 here. But the basic principle that the large-scale field growth can be understood by this magnetic helicity conservation so the saturation is occurring here because as the large-scale helicity grows, the small-scale helicity grows of the opposite sign, and that small-scale helicity back reacts on the alpha effect driving the growth, slowing therefore the overall growth rate. So this was manifest again in these equations here. The large-scale field grows, but then the small-scale helicity grows of the opposite sign. This combats this term here, so your overall growth term is then reduced. So that's the essence of this back reaction. Now,
is that symbolic? The same as what you have for steady state?
Yeah, exactly.
Steady state is that.
Yeah, and you can actually, I mean, once you have these equations at your disposal, we can't do everything quickly here, but one can sort of play and find exactly what the expected saturation value of it is, and you find that it's the large-scale helicity saturates at K1 over K2 squared times the small scale. So K2 over K1 is 5, this is 25, basically, in units of the small scale. So that sort of works. So that's one thing, and make one other point here, two other points, I guess, and that is that if you look at early times, you'll notice that these curves are plotted for, the curve I showed before is plotted for late times by late. At the moment, I'm not being specific, but I will be in this picture, and the agreement here is fairly well. But if I magnify this region here up, I get this when I compare the asymptotic fitting formula that Axel used to the early growth time scale that comes from the solution. So these are the solutions of those equations, and these are the asymptotic fits for late times for three different Reynolds numbers. And what one notices is that at early times, these equations predict a very important kinematic regime, a regime which is independent of magnetic Reynolds number, completely independent of magnetic Reynolds number. These are three different curves for three different Reynolds number, and you can see that the growth in this regime for all three of these curves proceeds independent of magnetic Reynolds number. It's only after a critical time scale at which the influence of the magnetic Reynolds number becomes important. And that's also...
is it the feeding of the data somehow not a scale? Why not probably just data?
Oh,
let's not think about that essentially. If you know everything from the simulation, the Reynolds number, our mass velocity, everything is known. You can't change that anymore.
What do you think?
Was that, I think you were asking, why do I use the asymptotic? Well, yeah,
you will be. Given time, where you know easily from simulation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And these are points, there's not actual data.
No, no. But there's two issues here. One issue is in this picture, what you're saying is exactly true. I used the fit to the data, which is essentially the same as...
Why not?
I could have, but it was easier to take the... Well, the fit is already quasi-empirical. So it's, you know, there's a formula that has a quasi-empirical fit. So one could take the data and do the same thing, but one gets almost exactly the same. It's exactly the same graph. But there's an important, but the question arises importantly when you look at this case. And the reason I don't fit the data here is because, I wanted to specifically demonstrate that the formula used to empirically fit the data at large times does not fit the solutions at early times. So these are the empirical formula, which worked at late times, and I'm extending them to early times, and they do not fit these.
Are there any data points?
In the paper, they weren't presented at the time. But
and these are different Reynolds numbers.
So yeah, all different Reynolds numbers.
I'm saying, of course, that the fit agrees at moderate Reynolds numbers are accessible. You can actually distinguish implicitly from the data.
Sorry. It's very important to distinguish late times and early times in this. That's the message I'm trying to give, is that the curves that fit, say more specifically, what are these curves? These dots. The dots are the axel's empirical fit to his data, which used an alpha and beta of this form, essentially. Resistively limited alpha and beta of that form were used to fit the data at these late times. And indeed, the solutions that I have presented for the set of two equations agree well with those kind of alpha and beta fits at these late times. But at early times, so if one extends this form of alpha and beta at late times, if one extends it to early times, this is what one would have. The solutions that, so the formula that he used were not used to fit his data at early times. They were only used to fit his data at late times. And I'm taking the same form of alpha and beta and extending that to, pretending that they actually do apply to early times, and then I find, in fact, that they do not apply at early times. And that's very important because it means that at early times, as you can see here, the Reynolds number, the actual growth that I find from these equations is independent, that we find is independent of the magnetic Reynolds number at early times, which means there's a significant kinematic regime to these dynamos that doesn't depend on magnetic Reynolds number. And that would be in contrast to the interpretation that you would gain by looking only at these forms, which emerge as quasi-reasonable in the late time steady state. In fact, if you were to be very, very naive and to apply this directly to something like the galaxy, the field magnitude that you get in the kinematic regime of the dynamo is already approximately within a factor of 5 of the actual observed galactic field, and you don't even have to worry about the late time regime of the dynamo. Now, applying to the galaxy directly is wrong for several reasons. This is an alpha squared dynamo. Galaxy is an alpha omega. Also, there's no boundaries, no shear, etc. But the message of this set of equations, of this dynamical quenching, is that there is a significant early kinematic phase of the dynamo, which does not depend on magnetic Reynolds number, and can lead to significant growth before the onset of the magnetic Reynolds number saturation kicks in and suppresses the field growth. So it's not enough for people to present the results of steady state treatments of the alpha and beta coefficients if you want to understand what their form is throughout the full evolution of the magnetic dynamo. Now, that being said, it does appear to be the case, and perhaps this is the last thing I should say, it does appear to be the case that indeed these asymptotically quenched forms, these late prime limits of the dynamo, are, in this alpha squared, simple alpha squared case, are resistively limited. That is, they do depend on Reynolds number, and if you think of an astrophysical system, how long, if one looks in these calculations, how long does it take to reach this stage? The time that it takes to reach this asymptotic stage is really of order the magnetic Reynolds number times the number of eddy turnover times, something like that. So clearly in a system like the Sun, you would reach this asymptotic stage. And one then wonders whether the dynamo is in fact resistively limited, and the way that you can, in principle, so what you want for the Sun is a case in which the dynamo is not actually resistively limited, because we have a cycle period which changes every 11 years, cycle periods of 11 years. So these periodic box simulations, what one wants to do at the next level is to understand how the helicity constraint applies to a more realistic dynamo, something like the Sun, and to try to infer whether it gives you the right cycle period.
And if it's eddy turnover times the square root of the Reynolds number?
It's the eddy times the Reynolds number, so 10 to the 6.
So you would never get that resistive regime within a single solar cycle.
No, not within a cycle. But once the system evolves, right, to the fully state, so the question is really, how does this, one question is, how does this apply? So the alpha squared dynamo has no cycle. So the alpha squared dynamo grows up a field and it saturates. The question that emerges is, when you have a dynamo with a cycle, an alpha omega dynamo, and this is something that Axel and I are trying to understand, how does the cycle, you know, what is the effect of the helicity, conservation business on the actual cycle period? Do you get the right cycle? Since the dynamo principle of helicity conservation seems to work so well for the alpha squared case in the simulations, what happens for more general dynamos? What does it predict for more general dynamos? That's something that needs to be understood. But the one point is that we have no boundary terms. I mean, all these calculations are for periodic box. And indeed, another way of losing helicity is through the boundary. And it may be, at the end of the day, I mean, one thing that we have to understand is, and we know in the Sun, helicity is being left, is being shot through the boundary. If it is the case that the dynamo saturates, and the reason it saturates, of course, is because you build up the small-scale magnetic helicity in this case, it may be possible in a real system to shed the small-scale magnetic helicity through the boundary, in which case you would alleviate this, ultimately alleviate the constraints that's put on by the growth of this small-scale magnetic helicity. So as you increase the large-scale field, you increase this of the opposite sign. But if you have a way of getting rid of this, you may be able to overcome the overall suppression of the dynamo. And so understanding whether that's required, whether for a real system this set of helicity equations can avoid the resistive regime by actually shedding the small-scale helicity through the boundary, through loops in the Sun, for example, remains to be understood. Okay, so let me just summarize the main the main issue. And by the way, summarize the main issue here, and that is that it seems that the back reaction on mean field dynamos, the mean field dynamo growth, can be understood within the framework, to some extent, of magnetic helicity conservation. The growth of the large-scale magnetic field that is associated with the growth of large-scale magnetic helicity, that comes at the expense of growing small-scale magnetic helicity of the opposite sign. The growth coefficient depends on the kinetic helicity minus the associated magnetic helicity, essentially. So when you grow the small-scale helicity, you are suppressing the growth of the large-scale field. And that interplay accounts for the dynamo suppression that's seen at least in simulations of the simplest form. So ultimately, the prescription that one would advocate, and that Axel, I guess, and I would advocate for mean field dynamo theory, is that you solve a set of mean field equations and you supplement that by the helicity conservation equation. So that's the effective procedure for coming up with a systematic back reaction that seems to work for magnetic dynamo theory. Solve the mean field equations and supplement that by magnetic helicity conservation. And we're still in the process of trying to understand whether this prescription, which is a tremendous simplification from always doing a full simulation, of course, whether this prescription does in fact capture more generalized dynamos. So that's the...
So do you expect that would slow down the effect of that on an oscillating dynamo, and after only would it be to limit the maximum radio and maybe slow it down, or what?
It seems. No. I mean, are you going to say something? Yes,
right. So first of all, once a dynamo has saturated at the small scale field level, so the small scale energy has reached the kinetic energy level. That is the point when the large-scale field can only grow more slowly.
Yes.
Now, the time between there and the final saturation for the sun would be maybe 8 times the 6 years.
Yes.
So now the sun at least has an age of 10 to the 6 years. Now, the next question is, how does it affect the cyclic period?
Yeah.
As you have seen from Eric's expression, it is only alpha that is quenched, not eta.
Mm.
This is a bit of an hypothesis at this moment still, but there's no theory which proves that at this point. So as long as alpha turbulent remains unquenched or only weakly quenched, not Reynolds number dependent quenched, as long as that is the case, the cycle period always depends on the turbulent diffusivity, and is therefore still on a dynamic time scale.
Yeah, there's in the alpha squared dynamo, another thing that emerges from the study is that, which is something I didn't really discuss, that there is a degeneracy. If you just plot the growth of the large scale field, there's actually a degeneracy in the form of alpha and beta that you can use to get the same growth curve. And the key point there is that the growth depends on their difference. And so you can have one which is if one is resistively limited, then both are resistively limited. But you can also start out the calculation assuming that beta is unquenched. You can start the calculation assuming beta is unquenched, and you can then calculate what your alpha is in saturation, and you would find that alpha, although the overall growth is resistively limited, the alpha itself is not resistively limited because the difference is what ends up emerging. And it's hard at the moment to distinguish between the proper form of beta. The same theoretical arguments, though, that go into producing an alpha suppression based on the difference between the kinetic and current helicity produce instead for beta an additive term. So while alpha goes to B dot curl of V minus B dot curl of V from the simple theory, which beta tends to go to B squared plus B squared with some coefficient here that's a little bit unclear, but positive. So the assessment, if one were to jump and take this at face value, essentially beta doesn't seem theoretically to be quenched, whereas the alpha does. So along the lines of what Axel was saying, if beta, in fact, if that does bear out in, you know, analysis, one would predict that the cycle period, which is dependent on mainly beta, would not change even if alpha incurs this quenching. So that's the... All right, so...
But watch this space, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
Watch this space.
Yes, that's right.
Two spaces.
Are you finished? Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
I think I may have missed Mayor McBoss concentration for a while. Probably about this division into large and small scale.
Okay.
I'm sure in the beginning a spectrum
right.
was pretty much continuous.
Right.
What is this? Where did it come from? And is it this all just emerging from the division, or I mean, could you make any other division
well,
get the same result? I mean, how do you believe this?
Right. The theory. I mean, in principle, one can write down a theory which, instead of fully dividing into two separate scales, every place you see a small scale quantity, you have some kind of integral, weighted integral. But I would, it's a tremendous two things I would say. One is why we do it, and the other is the justification. Why one does it is because it's a tremendous simplification, and it also is consistent with what has been seen in simulations of which we're testing. That is to say, there typically emerges two characteristic scales in the problem. One which is the forcing scale, and that scale emerges both, as I showed, as a peak.
But
all the quantities that are entering the formula, for example, if you calculate, but let's say you take the spectrum, which are approximately Kolmogorov, and you actually calculate where the dominant contribution is to all of the characteristic coefficients in the problem, such as alpha, so for example, alpha quantities like this, which has a correlation time associated with it, this tends to be dominated by the forcing scale. So, and that's true for all of the, that's true for this alpha coefficient, and it's true for, I mean, so the point is that in the equations, if you have a spectrum which is approximately Kolmogorov in these quantities, all of the relevant correlation coefficients times their effective correlation times end up being dominated by the forcing scale. So
you basically, what you're saying here is that you get two scales, basically, the very large and the very small, because the integrals either diverge on one side or they diverge on the other.
They
diverge in ultraviolet.
That's right. That's kind of right. That's right. I mean, what I'm basically saying is that from the forcing scale over here, this is the small. This represents the small scale stuff, and the small scale stuff is what enters into this quantity. So indeed, this is really a weighted integral. But if you put in an approximate Kolmogorov spectrum for the velocity, you will find that this is dominated by the contribution from the forcing scale primarily, and that's an assumption which is justified only in hindsight, in a sense, because if in fact we weren't working with helicity, this forcing helicity, then as I showed, the field is actually peaked on the resistive scale. So this is a convenient consistency between the fully helical forcing case and the everything is self-consistent in hindsight, because when you force with kinetic helicity, everything is dominated by the input forcing scale. The small scale stuff is dominated by the input forcing scale, and the large scale here is dominated by the Bach scale. This actually can be predicted. The scale for which the large scale goes can be predicted by the maximum scale of growth for the alpha squared dynamo, and that turns out to be this k equals 1 scale.
You're saying there's a certain coefficient in the equation that is rather there, this rather function k,
they will be sort of peaked in one direction, some others in the other, and then that makes it mathematical simpler to be.
Let's see, yeah. Let me see if I can say it a different way. I can see the question, in a sense.
I'm going to make it precise. It's not a two-scale analysis in the turbulence. Or in the velocity field, it's only a two-scale analysis in the magnetic field.
Yeah.
So the turbulence itself has a Kolmogorov spectrum and has a proper energy-carrying scale.
So that's why I'm sure why
and that is and that this scale is still a small scale, and now embed this in a domain, which is still somewhat bigger. So for the sun, for example, you would imagine that the cutoff, the energy-carrying scale would be maybe 50 megameters. Which is the Perkin scale head at the bottom of the convection zone.
Mm-hmm.
But 50 megameters is still small compared to the latitudinal extent over which the dynamo wave expands, which is about 500 megameters. So that almost up to an order of magnitude, which is certainly enough.
But I think you're asking
a factor of two or three would be enough.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it is true. Basically, you're I think in the let's see. I mean, of course, it's true that in reality there are always a spectrum of scales, but the quantities that are driving the growth in this problem, this and this and such, if you assume a spectrum for the turbulence which is approximately Kolmogorov, and then go back and calculate what these coefficients are, you find that they're dominated by the forcing scale of the turbulence. So it's and of course, if you assume a different spectrum to calculate them, you would not necessarily find them dominated by that forcing scale. But it turns out that the simulations give you a spectrum such that forcing scale does emerge as the dominant scale for those contributions, and that's a convenient accident in a sense. It's not you know, you look at the spectrum that emerges from simulation, then you estimate these quantities, and you find that, wow, you're lucky, the forcing scale is where the dominant contribution from them comes. The dynamics are dominated by that forcing scale. But that didn't necessarily have to be guaranteed to be the case. And in fact, if the spectrum were, for example, flat, or if it were really highly peaked at the smaller, the resistive scale, we wouldn't be so lucky. I mean, so. And I think that, as I said in the beginning also, the role of the fractional kinetic helicity in this small-scale field is very subtle. I mean, without putting in the fractional helicity, you notice the field was piled up on the resistive scale, and it's only after putting in that helicity that you get the field to be peaked at that forcing scale, which then justifies this two-scale approach. So, I mean, anyway, it's...